boys and girls, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for being here. This is Henrik Palmgren from Sweden, Scandinavia, and you are listening to an independent investigative radio program dedicated to finding authentic answers and truth, no matter how uncomfortable it might be. And we do not shy away from looking into dark and murky corners and tackle controversy in order to expose cover-up, corruption, and coercion. We cover a lot of different topics on this program. You might not like them all, but we are certainly trying to make it interesting and challenging for you as well. We are not here to simply confirm your worldview, but to challenge it and make you think. At the end of the day, if you agree with some of our guests or not, that we leave up to you. We just try to ask the questions so that you can get a better understanding of the people and the research that we talk about. Marty Leeds is back on the program today to talk about mathemagics, occult numerology, and the construction of the fairly recent English alphabet and its numerological values. Marty is the author of three books on the subject and a producer of countless of videos that shows the deconstruction of his particular method. Stay tuned for more. Hey, Marty, welcome back. Thanks for being here. I hope you're doing well today. Nice to have you back.
Hey, thanks for having me back on. Appreciate it.
You bet. So we did a couple of programs with you in 2012. That's actually a while ago now since we had you on. And you're, of course, released new material. You've I don't know if you had the DVDs out by then, but I think so. But two new books as well, I believe. So why don't we kind of just introduce you a little bit again to our audience? We get new listeners pretty much every day. And so we shouldn't assume that everyone has listened to our previous programs with you, Marty. So how would you introduce the work that you've been doing to someone who's new to all of this? And I think that there are a couple of keys, if you will, in your work. And I know that you wanted to talk a little bit about the history of the cipher that we've been talking a little bit about as well in the past.
Sure. Yeah. Basically, kind of what I'm known for is a cipher that I've uncovered for the English alphabet. It's a cryptogram that puts it's called gematria. It's called in Greek. It's called isopospy. It's Kabbalah. It's numerology. But it's basically this idea of putting numbers to letters. And so what I've uncovered is a cipher for the English alphabet. And it's based on a lot of these religious symbols and secret society symbols. And it's based around the transcendental infinite number of pi. An approximation of this. And so that's kind of what I'm known for. I do a lecture series online, YouTube, Marty Leeds 33, and then on my website, MartyLeeds33.com. And so I have a couple books. I just released, I guess, end of January here, I released a book called a second edition on Pi in the English Alphabet, Volume 1. And then I released a book called The Peacock's Tales, The Alchemical Writings of Claudia Pavonis. And then I'm going to be doing a second edition on my Volume 2, which should be out probably by the time this goes up, if not by the time it goes up on YouTube. So, yeah.
Really good. I want to talk more about the Peacock's Tale and all that too, a little bit later here. But
sure.
Tell us about the basics of the cipher then for people, and we can paint a picture for that. And then we can go into some of the history of it as well, because I guess you're not the first to use this, or maybe the breakdown of it is unique to you, Marty. I'm really not sure about that. You can tell us more about that.
Sure. Well, the cipher, I'll just go over it real quick. And basically what it is what I did is I took the 26 letters of the English alphabet and I split it in half. So I split it in the letters A through M and then N through Z. And then the first time I constructed this, I just used the motif that we see in the Holy Bible of this idea of God doing his work in 6 days and resting on the seventh or the Sabbath. And I used this motif and I literally just laid it on the alphabet. So I, you know, A through M and N through Z is the 13 letters per side of the alphabet. And I went A, B, C, D, E, F, G being 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And I stopped there. And then basically just to create symmetry or a balance on that side of the alphabet, I went A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M being 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. So A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 resting on that G. And then H, I, J, K, L, M is 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And then basically what I did is I took all those letters and I just kind of threw them onto the other side of the alphabet. So N, O, P, Q, R, S, T is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And then U, B, W, X, Y, Z is 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And this is basically the cipher for the English alphabet, as far as I can tell. And that's what I'm trying to prove or lay out the evidence for anyway. And so the first time I constructed this, I used basically, like I said, I used the motif that we see in the Holy Bible. But since then, I've constructed it a bunch of different ways. If you notice, we end on or we rest on G there. So we went 1, 2, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, and going 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and then walking back down. And the G, if you notice, is the letter that's in the Freemasonic square and compasses. We have that compass and square, and that's the letter right in the center of that. So that was one of the way that one of the ways that I used to deconstruct this. And so since this, let me also say this, it encodes pi as well. So we have 13 letters and 13 letters on each side. And so what you can do is actually take out the non-prime numbers on both sides of the alphabet. So the non-prime, well, prime is a number that's divisible by one in itself, of course. And the non-primes would be 1, 4, 6 and 6, 4, 1 on both sides of the alphabet. So you have 1 + 4 + 6 + 6 + 4 + 1 = 22. And the central pillar of this, of each side of the alphabet, is 7. And 22 divided by 7 is an approximation of pi begotten by whole numbers. It's 22 divided by 7 is 3.142. And so literally you have pi on basically both sides or both hands of your alphabet. And this is a very abridged or, you know, abbreviated deconstruction of this that I'm explaining right now. But you can see all these deconstructions on my website or on free lectures that I do online. I do a video series. But since then, I've deconstructed it using a bunch of different ways, and I'll just name some of them here. So like I just said, you can use pi and non-prime numbers. I used the Freemasonic square and compasses. I used the Jewish menorah, the Tetragrammaton, which is a symbol that's known as the Holy Name of God. Used by Kabbalists and alchemists and hermeticists and Christian Gnostics and all of this. And in the new book, I actually explained how you can use dice to deconstruct this. And then a couple other ways. The emblem of Israel has this whole symbolic deconstruction right on the symbol or the sign or the emblem of it, of course. And then the chromatic music scale. And so I've actually gone through every single one of these and showed how this works. Oh, there's actually one more too. There's the Ouija board, out of all things. Right. You can use the Ouija board. Hmm. So I've shown how basically this, you can get this very, very particular number to letter correlation for the English alphabet based on all of these different religious symbols, secret society symbols, games, things like that. So that's basically the work in a nutshell, the cipher in a nutshell. And then all what I've done is gone and basically taken this thing on a world tour. I've just gone all different places and all the different ways we can look at this. Like I've looked at, you know, that, well, and we'll probably talk about some of this, but like the name of Jesus Christ, I did on the Holy Bible, I did on the solar system, I did it on, like I said, dice, chess, I did it, you know, et cetera, et cetera. There's just a whole bunch of ways. I think I have maybe like 40 or 50 videos up there of all a bunch of different subjects. So yeah. That you can take a look at for absolutely free. So
can you use anything, do you think, as long as it's within the realm of being in some a religious or a spiritual connotation behind it?
Right now, from what I've seen, it works on pretty much anything that has been basically created or written with this language. It's really hard to say because I've looked at a bunch of different things, but there's so much more to look into. I literally have a list of like, 50 other things that I want to look into. I just don't have time, you know?
Yeah.
So, but I'll say this, everything I've looked into thus far, this thing seems to work on, and it really kind of draws out, I would say, higher levels of information within these things. One of the things I deconstruct I have two videos on this, I believe. It's chess and showing how chess encodes two lunar, a solar, and precessional calendar, as well as multiple ways of encoding pi within the pieces of chess. And this is a very, very particular, very precise deconstruction where it's the idea that of you're putting numbers to letters of the characters of chess that have very particular spellings, and you're getting multiple calendars out of this. And so it really shows that if any of these letters would have been off or any of these numbers would have been off, the whole thing would have not worked. And so you can see that something like chess, that this was occulted or obfuscated or hidden within the game of chess and has been passed on into the English language as well, because chess is an extremely old game. I think the first instance of chess it probably has survived prehistory, but thousands of years.
Very old. Yeah.
Very
old. Something strange in the origins of chess, where it comes from and how it was developed. But it's just it's an extraordinary game.
It is. It is, for sure.
So how do you explain that this methodology that you managed to find it in all these, all these games and kind of ritual, spiritual context, that kind of material? Why is that? How does that work?
Well, as far as I can tell, and my own personal journey through this stuff, is that spiritual ideas have a direct geometric and numeric metaphor, and that all of these ancient religious texts were written mathematically. So, and not even just the scripture and things like that. It's also things like chess, that when they were developing chess, or when they were translating it from whatever language it was, whether it's, you know, Sanskrit or Latin or whatever it is, that they did this with the mathematics in mind. And that's what I'm trying to show. And so my own journey through this is that all of these things have a mathematical metaphor. And let me just give you an example. You know, the Holy Bible begins with, Let me say this before I go on. The Holy Bible is, of course, not a literal document. Anyone that's done any sort of studying on this whatsoever knows that you're never supposed to take this thing literally. It's not a historical text. It's not a textbook. You know what I mean? This isn't an account of history. That this is allegory. It's symbolism. It's psychology. It's philosophy. It's astrotheology. It's anatomy, et cetera, et cetera. So let me just say that to, you know, preface this. When you look at Genesis 1:1, right, it says, in the beginning, God created heaven and the earth. And then it goes on. And, you know, the earth was formless and void, or without void, and you know, the darkness on the face of the deep, and et cetera, et cetera. Well, how many people just read? Millions of people have just read this first line and just gone on, you know, just moved on without even really stopping to think, well, wait a second. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. What they're saying there is that this is a really consistent theme throughout sacred geometrical canon, that heaven is a circle and earth is a square. And this is in Buddhism, this is in Taoism, this is in Freemasonry, this is in Hermeticism, this is in alchemy, this is all of this stuff hails from Egypt, so we can probably say it was from Egypt, right? So we have this idea that the very first verse of Genesis, of the Holy Bible, the Old Testament, is saying that in the beginning, God created a circle and a square. And really what this does is initiates you into this very deep symbolic language, what I consider a language, and what some of the greatest minds of the world, like Galileo and Kepler and Plato and Pythagoras, said, this language of the creator that is mathematics and geometry. And this is, in the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. In the beginning, God created the circle and the square. And they are talking about squaring the circle. And of course, squaring the circle is exactly what the Great Pyramid of Giza does. So we get a much deeper understanding of what is being held within the text that's behind all of this.
Yeah, it would be interesting to see what other, you know, world myths or even scriptures this would work on out there. I mean, I'm thinking, for example, of other examples coming out of the tradition of gematria with the Bible code, of course, but then with people who've done basically a similar thing on Shakespeare's work. There's a Norwegian gentleman, Petter Amundsen, I'm going to try to get him on, but he found this in the one of the Shakespeare's first folios. I think he found a string of cipher that points to the, you know, the Knights Templar Oak Island mystery, for example. There's like, I think that there might be something to, of course, these very potent work that have been released and then they've become very important throughout history, maybe because people know this flat out, or they understand it subconsciously or something. But it would be really interesting to see about how many works of literature it would work on. Maybe some of the classics out there this would, you know, fit within, but more kind of just empty, you know, novel literature would just kind of fall outside of this. I don't know. What do you think, Marty?
Yeah, actually, this is a great segue now that you brought up William Shakespeare, because maybe we can talk about the history of some of this, because I think William Shakespeare's, I think that all of his work is encoding this mathematics.
Right.
And maybe let's go into the history a little bit, and then we'll kind of come back to William Shakespeare a little bit. The history of this, we have some really interesting things going on when we had the establishment, and this is very well confirmed. We had at one point in our history the establishment of the 26 letters of our modern English alphabet as we speak it today. And so this really happens. Basically, we got to kind of carve out a chunk of time here, but it's, you know, say like, we're going to say like 1450 to like 1650, or maybe 1500 to 1650, you know, we're talking about the 16th and 17th century. Well, we had like a ton of things going on at this point that really shows that there was some sort of a renaissance of mind, a change going on. And this is exactly when the English alphabet, the modern English alphabet, was established. You had at this time, well, you had a renaissance of science and art. You had guys like, Kepler, Copernicus, Francis Bacon, Rene Descartes, Giordano Bruno. He died in 1600s. I think we just had his birthday too. Celebrated his birthday. So, yep. So the sciences, you know, then you had artists, you had guys like, well, the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, man, Michelangelo, Donatello, or Leonardo, Raphael, I guess Donatello was probably earlier than that. But, and then you had this rise of alchemy as well. You had guys like John Dee, Edward Kelly, they were living at this time, right? The court astrologers for what, Elizabeth I, I guess. Daniel Milius, Johannes Daniel Milius. He did one of the most famous alchemical illustrations or paintings called Opus Medico Chemicum. And that was done in 1618. You have Anastasius Kircher, Michael Mayer, who did Atlantifugians. You had Henrik Nolius. All of these great alchemists living at this time. What else was going on? You had what was called this thing called the Great Vowel Shift, where there was literally a change in how we pronounced vowels in our language. And this is pretty well established by academia. This is really no question. And this was going on from, like I said, 1400 to 1600, around that time. What else do you have? The first dictionaries being printed. 1604 was the first dictionaries being printed. So we had the first dictionaries being printed in this time frame, and this is when the establishment of, you know, the 26 letters was being established. So, these are two other big ones. You had the original translation of the Greek text, the translation from King James into the modern English version of the Bible. Mm-hmm. So the authorized version, the King James Bible, was done in 1611. So once again, we're right in that time frame. And then, of course, here's a really big kicker. What else was going on? The establishment of Freemasonry. It's very well known that Freemasonry was established in the 15th and 16th century. And of course, like I said, one of the ways I deconstructed this cipher was with that Freemasonic square and compass. And that's, of course, it was established at that time. And so you had all of this going on, right? You had a resurgence of alchemy. You had a renaissance of thought. You had the first dictionaries being printed. You had a great vowel shift. You had, what else? The translation of the Bible, all of this stuff. And then to top it all off, to bring it back to William Shakespeare, you had one of the greatest literary figures of all time, without even quiz, not even really an opinion, you know, William Shakespeare. And now we know also that William Shakespeare, I mean, there's a lot of evidence pointing that he wasn't just a singular man, that this was probably a guild of writers that were writing these mm-hmm. these plays and sonnets, right. And whatnot. And of course, what were these writers? They were poets, they were astrologers, they were alchemists, they were theologians, they were philosophers, etc., you know. And it's said that William Shakespeare was said, this guild of writers alone had given us over 20,000 of our modern English words. You know, so basically you had a group of people that were taking, Latin, Middle English, Greek, Hebrew, etc., and crafting these new words. And what all I'm saying is that basically my thesis is, if you will, and I'm trying to lay this out logically and put the evidence for it, is that during this time when the English alphabet was established or founded or channeled or decided upon or whatever, that during this time with all of that stuff going on, they crafted a mathematics to it. And understanding these ancient Hebrew, understanding that, understanding that Hebrew, Greek, and Latin, that those Bibles were written mathematically. Now, I don't know if we have a cipher for Latin, but I know for a fact that we still have the ciphers for Hebrew and Greek. And so, and I even print them in the back of my book. So we have all of these other languages that absolutely have mathematics to them. That I'm not even joking. You can buy a Hebrew Bible or a Greek Bible today and read it mathematically. It's not, that's anybody can do that. So all I'm saying is that when it was translated into that authorized King James Version, that they did it mathematically. So that's kind of the historical breakdown. Let me say one other thing here too, is just to really break this down. When I said in the cipher, it goes A, B, C, D, E, F, G, right? And we go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and that we rest on there. Well, and of course, once again, that's the Freemasonic square and compass. Well, A is 1, B is 2, C is 3, D is 4, E is 5, F is 6, and G is 7. Well, the opening line of Hamlet, which is one of the most, this is well-known, celebrated plays of all time. The opening line, we all know it. It says, to be or not to be? That is the question. So these writers, we're saying, hey, this is a riddle. We're asking you a question, and there's an answer to the question, what is it? To be or not to be, that is the question. Well, if they were cryptically encoding this cipher, the answer is to be. There's an answer to that riddle, and that's the opening lines of Hamlet. And so that's just one of the things. And I have, like I said, I haven't had a chance to really look into William Shakespeare enough, but so that's just kind of the history surrounding this cipher and why I think that really shows a lot of evidence to say that this is correct, if you will.
Wow. Well, that's very interesting. I remember another gentleman up in Sweden at the time, a contemporary, if you will. He lived from 1568 to about 1652. His name was Johannes Bureus. He was called a Renaissance rune magician. And basically everyone who's interested in people like John Dee and Francis Bacon should check out this guy, because he's basically like a mix between the two. He was also an advisor to the king at the time, just like Bacon, you know. Bureus, he was allegedly involved in developing the Swedish language as well, actually. And he was primarily looking at the Gothic Scandinavian runes and doing very much the same thing, translating these into numbers and numerology. And to be honest, I haven't done that much work on this, but there's a whole nother key and clue there. And I think it comes on the backdrop of Carl von Linné, who later starts naming all the plants and everything in Latin and stuff like that. So there's another key there. And I think it's something that you would find in a lot of the ancient languages. That's my point anyway. I think that when they have a root way, way, way back into history, I think there are common denominators, and I think we can find this mathematical system kind of contained in the majority of those languages, Marty.
Yeah, I mean, if you read any of these like esoteric writers or even like Freemasonic scholars or anything like that, this is a consistent theme. I mean, whether it's like, you know, you could go to Albert Pike or Manly P. Hall, or we could look at Thomas Burgoyne, you could go to Alvin Boyd Kuhn, you could go to Carl Anderson again and again and again. I mean, I have a stack of books on my bookshelf, and every single one of them talk about the fact that this was well known at the time, you know, and it's just kind of been lost in our own day. And I'm really trying to do my best to not only put the evidence out, and if you will, the proofs out, to say that this is correct and show all the ways that it can be used. But, you know, also show that, there's a spiritual connection, and right. that's the other thing that I'm trying to really show, because that's the experience that I've had. And so I don't want to just lay out some academic case. I want to also show that, hey, this is the journey that I've made through this stuff, and this is what this stuff means to me. And I'm, you know, it's very close to my heart. I'm very passionate about it, and that's what I'm trying to do anyway.
Very good. So before we carry on talking more about this, what do you think happened to this? Was it really lost? Did we just forget about it? Is it part of a bigger cycle of rise and fall of intellectual and alchemical spiritual knowledge that rises and falls, just like civilization and all other things in our world? What do you think?
Well, I mean, what it does is, in my opinion, not even in my opinion, it's like what I'm trying to show once again, is that really what it does is clarify what, like, for instance, what the Holy Bible is, you know. And it really, what it shows is that this is a mathematical document, in one respect, of course, but that you can prove this, and that it shows that you can't take something like the Bible literally. And when you have information like this, the Bible is just a tool. The singer-songwriter Ani DeFranco, where she says, every tool is a weapon if you hold it right. Well, the Bible is just a tool. So if you can hide this stuff and therefore hide the true meaning of the text, then you can use the text for exactly what it's being used for right now: mind control, manipulation, a perversion of our history, et cetera, turning mythology into history, and convincing masses of people that this is what this book really means. And so, in my opinion, this was known at a time, and then just like all throughout history, and this is why a lot of these secret societies ended up popping up, was to hold on to this information, because this information allows you to clarify and validate what it is you're actually looking at. And of course, the Holy Bible is, it's a very controversial document. I'm well aware of that. But, and so is Freemasonry. Freemasonry is a very controversial organization, but I think it's in its original inception, Freemasonry, Holy Bible, that these were noble, holy institutions that were trying to pass on deep occult wisdom of great antiquity. You know, Acts, I think it's 22:7 or 7:22. I don't know which one it is, but it says Moses was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians. Yeah. And it's well known that all of this stuff comes from Egypt. So a lot of times we look back and we say, well, God, what were those crazy Egyptians doing? Well, I'm saying that we can figure out what they were doing, that this information is being passed on to us, and it's only the Holy Roman Empire, the Vatican, the governments of the world or whatever that are trying to hide this. So the people, average people like you and I, will not have access to this. And to me, this is one of the most egregious sins.
Do you think that people are drawn to this kind of work in a subconscious way as well? I mean, talking about the Bible here in this case, because otherwise people would just kind of turn away from it, right? If there was nothing in there, no big parables or something that's important or resonate with people, that were just like, it's just another book. But it keeps on alluring people, if you will. I mean, even people who have lost the religious aspect of it, like, you know, I guess yourself, Marty, but are attracted to the Bible for a very, very different reason, but finds still then tremendous value and lessons and this kind of, you know, key within it, right?
Yeah, I mean, the reason, this is the best way I can make sense of it anyway. The reason that the Bible works in any way, whether it's true spirituality or if it's whether, you know, mind control, manipulation, that sort of thing. The reason that it works is because it's written symbolically. And symbolism affects us very deeply. It's how the creator, if you will, the nature force, that's what the creator is. That's what the logos is. It's a force of nature. This is how the creator, this great mystery, great spirit, speaks to us. And symbolism affects us very deeply, very subconsciously. And that's pretty much well known. You don't need to hear that from my mouth to just go look at any corporation. And they use these symbols because they affect us subconsciously. And these people know this. And so when you write a book that's symbolic, the reason that it works is because that symbolism is affecting you very deeply. The symbol of the cross will affect you very deeply, even though you might not be cognizant or conscious of it at all. And this is what these ancient people understood. I mean, the Holy Bible is a glorification and exaltation of nature. That's what it is. I mean, it's all symbolic stories, but that's what that's what it's doing. This is why Jesus is an anthropomorphized sun god. They're not worshiping the sun, but they're worshiping the cycles of nature, which elucidate the creator's cosmic principles, if you will. And so this is why I think the Holy Bible works even to this day, even to people that are, you know, extremely ignorant or have no idea about any of this stuff. I mean, how many people read the Bible today and have absolutely no idea about any of this? You know, nothing. They don't know any about the symbolism, the numerology, the psychology, any of it. And this is what I'm doing my best to try to clarify, you know, if I may too. Yeah. I need to say this. The only Bible that's worth its salt is the Authorized King James Version.
Why?
And the reason I say this is the people that wrote this, as I just showed the history of, you know, I just kind of went over the history, is the people that translated that from the original Greek text understood the mathematical structure beneath it. And when they were, and this is why this is the Authorized King James Version is the version of the Freemasons, is because they understand that there were mathematics, you know, behind this. And when they were translating those stories, they were translating the mathematics as well, right? All of these new Bibles, the New Living Translation, the New King James Version, the whatever, God's Word Translation, every single one of those are bastardized perversions of the original text. And this is, and I've done some comparisons of these texts, and it's literally night and day when you start to look at the mathematics behind it. I just wanted to make that kind of clear.
Certainly. Yeah, definitely. That's where you have to look. You have to find that kind of same strain, if you will. Do you think that a lot of people passed it? I mean, after 1600, 1700s, when we're into that era there, do you think it's pretty much lost at that point, or does it go underground as so many things does around that time?
I think it went underground. Yeah. I mean, I'm not sure how many people knew it. You know, but I think that one of the reasons that William Shakespeare's work was so celebrated at the time is that I think that people were aware of it. And I think something like this could be found and lost very quickly. Like, I even think about it in the context of my own life. I mean, I have a few thousand people that have watched my videos on YouTube or whatever, and a couple thousand people have bought the books or whatever. But I mean, how many of those people actually have intuited this knowledge and understand it and are going to pass it on to their progeny? Probably not a lot of them, you know? And so how fast could this get lost? As fast as it could be found again or, you know, understood, it can be lost.
Right.
And that's just nature in and of itself. I mean, nature is, that's just what she does. Things get gone. Things become extinct. It's the law of the land, you know?
So what would you say about, in relation to the importance about the knowledge that you've drawn forth? What does it, you know, tell us about our world, the universe and reality? What, who we are, where we're going, etc.?
What I've gotten from it is the deep connection that man has to the entire universe. And if I guess I don't know how to say this, but that our universe is created, if you will, in our brain. It's a perception that we know this from like quantum physics and normal physics and things like this, that the world doesn't even really look like this. It only looks like this to us, you know? If you go into the quantum world, everything is happening all at once. It's superposition. It's, you know, quantum entanglement. It's popping in and out of space. Everything you can measure it, but you can't find out where it is, you know, et cetera, all of these sorts of ideas. And so from that scale, the universe doesn't look anything like this. And so our perception, the human consciousness and the perception is integral. It's absolutely integral to understand our universe. And this is something that modern science is basically just dismissing. Right. I mean, yep. they basically what, you know, the contemporary paradigm is this idea that it's like, well, the world would just be kicking on if the human beings weren't here. Well, I think that these philosophers and theologians and people that really understood this understood that there was a connection to nature and that languages, even if they are created, are blooming from nature in and of itself, if you will, that this is just a yet another expression of nature. And this connects us to this great spirit, great mystery, what, you know, the Native Americans called Suineo or Wakantanka, and what the, you know, Hebrews called, you know, et cetera, right? And this is how I understand it, that the human being and its consciousness is an integral part of this. And maybe we could go into this, some of this in the like next hour or something like that, because I'd really like to clarify that statement too. So.
Okay, but, sure. Now, how was your journey was a little bit like that as well, as I understand, as I'm reading some of the books here, Marty, that you sent to me, that you was, you know, you come from a kind of a, or you came from a kind of a reductionist scientific kind of point of view and understanding of it in that way, as opposed to something when you came into later about that creation and nature has a meaning to it. There is a sense to it. There's something that, you know, you discovered along the way in that, right?
Yeah. I mean, I started out, you know, when I started, you know, becoming an avid reader or whatever, 18, 17, 18 years old or whatever. I mean, I read science. I, in fact, completely rejected religion and philosophy because I was all, well, that's all interpretive. You know, you could spend years in that and not get anywhere. I want science. So I read, you know, the entire works of Carl Sagan. I read Stephen Hawking, Brian Greene, those guys, you know, that I got into physics and that sort of thing. So I started there. And for years, that's all I focused on. And so that was where I built my foundation. And so when I went into religious ideas, philosophical ideas, things like that, I wanted to go into it with that scientific foundation, understanding these subjects with the foundation of the fundamental tenets of science, if you will. And the only way that I could really do that was with mathematics. And then that led me into the study of mathematics. And I had this completely unshackled, untethered approach to going into mathematics because I'm a college dropout. You know, I had no one saying that, hey, you can't do that.
Right.
What are you doing? There, you know, that's numerological. Oh, don't be silly. Don't be a fool. And so this really led me just explore all of this stuff freely. And then also, I mean, our generation, I'll have to say that I've been so influenced by so many great researchers that are around right now. Just like guys like Laird Scranton. Without his book, Science of the Dogon, I wouldn't be doing this. You know, cosmological origin, myth, and symbol. I wouldn't be doing this. You know, guys like Randall Carlson, Scott Onstad, Merkel Roden, John Anthony West. You know, all of these guys have been so influential and so it's just an integral part of having me understand this stuff. So I kind of went into all of this stuff with a scientific background, but then understanding also that science was so boxed in. Their thinking was, I mean, it's critical thinking that's gone to an extreme. That's not even critical thinking anymore. It's just thinking that criticizes, if you will, you know, and I realized that that was very arrogant and that there was so many things that wasn't covering. And so that allowed me some freedom to go into this. And that freedom allowed me to see that there was meaning to this stuff. There was something deeply spiritual about the Holy Bible. Of course, you have to reject the literalism. You have to reject the organized religious viewpoint. You have to reject the Vatican. You have to reject, you know, oh, I've got to have this savior. I got to go to church and put my money in a basket, and that's how you're going to be saved. You have to reject all of that. And as soon as you do that, then the chains fall off. The shackles fall off. The guilt falls away. There's no indoctrination. There's no dogma, you know, and that was... Well, what religion is supposed to do is true religion, true spirituality, if you will, is free you and not bind you. You know, religion actually means re, to do again, and bind, It's ligare or ligare or ligio, Latin, Sanskrit. It has a bunch of etymological roots, but it means to rebind, relink, or rechain. Well, there's two versions of this word that we can look at. So that means that religion is there to bind us, to rebind us, to chain us, to strip away our spiritual sovereignty. But it's also to rebind, to rechain, to relink to the creator. You know, religion actually means a bond between God and humans. So, you know, to rebind through religion, but of course that's not the organized religion. You know what I mean? That's not believing in some bullshit belief system. That's going into the self and truly finding it.
Yeah. Now, there's so much here, of course, but part of the work here I've been to that you do is even looking at what we are physically as well. I mean, that we're built on the same template from the creation, if you will, from the number of bones in our body to the phalanges of our hands and everything. Like, there is a system in place here that is repetitive throughout everything that we see in nature, and to a certain degree, of course, what we create as human beings as well, because we are, since we're part of the system, we're going to replicate the same numerology, right?
Yeah, I mean, what is it? Pythagoras said that man is the measure of all things, right? Genesis 1:27 says, God made man in his own image. In the image of God created he him. Male and female created he them. It's this idea that we are a reflection of this creator. And that by understanding the selves, therefore, we can understand the cosmological principles, the attributes, the laws of nature that created us. Because we are this, the human being is this sort of ne plus ultra expression of all of the universe. I mean, think about it this way. After 13.75 billion years of cosmic evolution, and then what, 4.2, 4.6 billion years of earthly evolution, or 6,000, whatever you believe, we were the last thing that the universe decided to do, you know? I mean, so out of all of that time, we are the last thing that the universe decided to do. So it's really saying that, you know, we are an expression of that, of the universe, and that understanding the self will help us understand this intelligent force that lies beneath the creation. Do you mind if I read a quote here?
No, go ahead.
Just uncovered. Yeah, this is from, I just read this last night and I was like, Jesus, this is amazing. This comes from Alvin Boyd Kuhn collection. It says here, and this is really talking about the fact that understanding nature, understanding the self, will help you understand the symbolic cosmological principles of the creator. And this is what all of these ancient cultures are doing. I mean, what tribes are doing right now when they go to worship an animal. They're not worshiping the animal. They're worshiping what the animal, the attributes, and what the cosmological principles and what the animal is symbolic of. It says, these ancient dramatists knew a fact that we are largely ignorant of, that the processes and phenomena of creatural life are everywhere themselves, the pictorial dramatizations of universal verity. They knew that every tree, bush, insect, worm, beast, every tumbling rill upon the hillside, every cloud, snowflake, mist, and rainfall was each in its way a visible delineation of cosmic principle. For these processes and creations were themselves the outward, visible manifestation of the soul of the universe that was working to give itself concrete expression in myriads and variant forms. They were themselves truth come alive in the actual world. They were universal spirits, ideas that were now crystallized in material form in the outer world. They were God's archetypal ideas, concretized in atomic matter as an architect's ideas become substantialized in brick, mortar, wood, and stone. And precisely so, God, the great architect, first formed in his cosmic mind, the shape of things to come in his purposed new creation, and it was over the ideal pattern that he later formed the physical universe. So we are that concretized, crystallized thought of God, and we are the if you will, the expression of it.
Yeah.
And that's what's being said time and time and time again through all of these ancient philosophies. And it's something that I think is absolutely true.
Well, indeed. Some great work from Kuhn. He I think was influenced by Gerald Massey quite a bit as well. And just
sure.
Just his very idea as well that the Bible derives its origins from, you know, quote unquote, pagan religions, right? That much of Christianity was found in Egyptian and even Babylonian mythology, that it, you know, it goes through revisions, of course, sure, but the core of the components in there are very much the same. And it's the one story in a way that's being retold over and over and over again.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. I mean, the Bible, as far as I can tell, is just it's an amalgamation of Hindu, pagan, Christian, Buddhist, you know, all of these different, you know, Phoenician, whatever, all of these different Greek, of course, all of these different mythologies that's been just once again recapitulated or reimagined for our modern times in the modern alphabet. That's how I see it anyway. And this idea that there's really only one story playing out is that the universe is telling us this. It's unified. There is only one story. There was the story of the universe and that we are part of it. So if we want to understand the story of the universe, we have to start with ourselves. We have to start with the last thing the universe started to do. And then we have to go through the religious process of relinking ourselves back. And this is really what, it's the idea that the singularity bloomed into the multiplicity. God, the grand architect, the great geometer, dismembered itself. So we would go for the very purpose of going for us to go through the act of remembering ourselves and remembering where we came from and what we're doing here. And this is, once again, this is just a consistent theme that you see all over in all of these philosophers and theologians and theosophists and whatnot. So, and it's one I've absolutely embraced because I think it just makes a whole lot of sense. So,
well, indeed. So do you believe that there's an update of this work for our time that will take this story back again into something that is of context to us today? I mean, it's again, the story in that sense, the core of it, it does remain the same, but it seems that there's been retellings or it comes in a new format, if you will, now and then, and there's updates to it. And I know a lot of people don't like that, specifically, you know, staunch Christians and everything, but I do believe that there is a continuum, if you will, within the core. And again, that's the reason why people are drawn to it too, because otherwise, if it was all bunk in there, nothing to it, why would so many people be attracted to it? There's something there, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, I mean, I think before we can start to make new stories, if you will, I think we have to understand the old stories. Because
right.
You know, it's just like anything, you know, if you want to understand trigonometry or algebra or, you know, that sort of thing, well, you have to know your multiplication tables first. You have to understand the fundamentals first. So I think before that we can start making our own new stories and things like this, that we have to understand the old stories and truly what's beneath this, like the Holy Bible and things like this, all of these texts. I mean, I think this is the Zohar, the Mahabharata, the Upanishads, the Talmud, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I think all of these ancient scriptural texts are encoding this deep mathematical base. And I think that we have to, as a humanity, come back to understanding symbolism, mathematics, and geometry, because to me, these three create the universal language of the creator, the nature force, once again. So, I think one sure. person that has done it in, I guess, our time is James Joyce. I think James Joyce, I mean, Finnegan's Wake, that book is about 10,000 different stories, 10,000 different lives, all brought into Humphrey Chipton Earwicker. It's one character that lives a billion lives, and he's just telling the same story again and again and again and again. And the story is about you coming to, well, what did Buddha do? He woke up. That's what Buddha means. He was Siddhartha Gautama, right? And then he became Buddha. He woke up. Well, that's the same thing that was happening with Humphrey Chipton Earwicker in the book Finnegan's Wake. It's Finnegan. He's waking. He's waking up to his true divine nature.
So now, do you think that ancient man, difficult to answer perhaps, but was unconscious of the value of what they were writing as they were, you know, scribbling down these stories, or was? Because I always try to get closer to that. There seems to have been a connection to nature, which was more, you know, prominent when we look back into history. It's something we've kind of, not that we've lost it, but we've grown in a different direction away from it to a certain extent. But as we look back then to ancient man, we can see that there was a tremendous value in that close connection with nature. And to a certain extent, it's like we've kind of lost that for some reason. I don't know if you would agree with that.
I would absolutely. I mean, we are divorcing ourselves. I mean, you know, I'm speaking a little bit mystically here, but we've abandoned Father Sky and we're raping and pillaging Mother Earth. You know, this is the cosmic sexual union that's happening all the time. And we're completely disregarding, you know, our environment. And I think that so much comes from nature. I mean, I've spent, you know, people ask me, well, how did you come about this information? Where'd you get this stuff? And I was like, well, okay, yeah, I've read some books. I've been really influenced by all of these great writers and researchers and all, you know, all of this. But I also spent an enormous amount of time in nature. I mean, just an enormous amount of time. I'm moving back to Eugene. I used to live there for Eugene, Oregon. I used to live there for 5 years, and I lived about a quarter mile away from just miles and miles of trails. And I would go, you know, 3-4 times a week, and literally for about 3 hours a day after work or whatever, I would go by myself and I would go hiking just all the time. And I'm an avid hiker. I would go on my bike and I would spend a lot of time in deep meditative, contemplative state. It was emerged in nature. And I think that, you know, people ask like, well, you know, how do you do some of this stuff? Well, I think that's a huge part of it. So I think that we've been divorced and we've lost that. We're getting farther away from it.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, absolutely. We see it every day. I think a lot of people are, it's kind of scary, but it's not only technology and things like that. It's a different kind of divorce, good word you used there for it, an attitude of just that we are to a certain extent able to just transcend completely the natural order, like we stand outside of it and it doesn't matter what we can do. And, you know, to a certain extent, sure, there might be an expression of the fact that people want to be transcendent, if you will, of the what they perhaps see as limitations within nature. But nonetheless, if those are forces that you begin to work with, there's a tremendous benefit there. The more you struggle against, try to, you know, divorce yourself from that, I think the more and more difficult and complicated we will make things, as opposed to just kind of going with what's there and learning to understand what works in nature and what doesn't, you know. So I'm really worried what I'm seeing in terms of how people are moving away from that. And there's no anchoring at all into what system, if you will, that they've been born into. It's a completely artificial bubble that people live in. Very scary to me.
It's very scary. Yeah, I'm glad you said that, because it really is. And this isn't, you know, so much so that I find the whole transhumanism movement kind of ridiculous, you know. And I'm probably not going to win over a lot of fans with that, but, you know, to me it's, I mean, when you look back at history, I mean, we just talked about this a little bit, but everything gets gone. You know, I mean, nothing lasts. You know, it's like, can you name one culture that existed in 2500 BC that exists now in the state that they were in back then? Of course not. Everything changes. You have all, you know, and so when people believe that we're going to merge with machines and live forever in the material world, I'm just like, you know what, this isn't going to last. And that isn't doom and gloom or anything like that. That's just how nature works. If you embrace it, you realize that, you know, clinging on to the material world is ridiculous. It's silly. You know, we can't reject the material world, of course. I mean, I think that we do our spiritual work through the material world. There's always been this, you know, kind of like teeter totter or back and forth between spirit and matter. Well, no, it's, you know, matter. We got to, you know, forget about that. It's all about the spirit elevating ourselves. It's all good, man. You know, that sort of thing. And I think we do our spiritual work through matter. And I think therefore we have to take care of this material world, this Mother Earth. I mean, that's what matter comes from the word mater, which means mother. You know, and so it's, you know, when you look at spiritual work, you know, it's like, well, okay, well, let's just go to the language here. You know, does matter matter? Well, yeah, of course it does. The word is telling you it matters, you know. Okay, if matter comes from mater and mater means mother, let me ask you, does your mother matter? Well, yeah, she gave birth to you, dude. You know, it's these kind of things that we have to embrace. And I guess one of the things that I'm trying to do with this is show how all of these principles about the exaltation of nature is embodied and embedded in our language. Like in that example, like I just gave you, you know, and so I think that reconnecting with this mysticism, this occult ideologies and things like that through our language and things like that actually will draw us closer to nature, in my opinion. And I think in one respect, like we were talking about before, this is what the Holy Bible is. What we have to do is just grow up, come to our childhood's end, and, you know, not be so superstitious about this bullshit. You know, go in and realize, oh, okay, is, you know, was there two English chaps, Adam and Eve in a garden, really talking to a snake, or is it parable and allegory? Are we going to be grown up about this, or are we going to be childish about this? Because if you understand that that's an allegory, then we might get to say, hey, is Adam about the odd numbers and Eve about the even numbers? Is this what we're talking about here? And then, once again, what does that have to do with anything with nature? Well, according to, once again, Galileo, Kepler, Plato, Pythagoras, this is the language of the creator. And that creator is working through nature. That's how we understand the creator.
And those people were that were natural scientists that were just not scientists. Something got lost, you know, along the way, as some of these alchemists lost the al and simply became, you know, chemists. And that's how I see the advancement of things. That okay, it started out in a good, you know, position, but then it's something got lost along the way, and we half the story is the holistic approach got lost along the way, if you will. But Marty, why don't we take a short break here in a little bit? I wanted to give out some details, of course, where people can find more of your work, your website and such as well. You have a couple of book titles you want to give out. You have DVDs as well. And you just told me, of course, that volume 2, I think, of Pi and the English Alphabet is going to be out soon as well. So, yeah, tell us about it.
Sure. Yeah. So Pi and the English Alphabet volume 1 just came out. This is the second edition of it. So I did a second edition of volume 1 and volume 2. So that first one just came out along with my new book, The Peacock's Tales, The Alchemical Writings of Claudia Bovonis, which is basically, I just kind of give some personal anecdotes of my own life, how I came about this information, stuff like that. And then the second volume will be out, like I said, probably in a week or two. And then after that, I'll be working on volume 3, which I already have kind of sketched out, outlined in that. And then, yeah, I've got just some, I got like a gematria calculator. You can just go to my site and check out some of the stuff, some DVDs and that. I also have a music CD that I just recorded this year, a 10 song that you can get on my iTunes and Amazon and my site as well. So, and then Marty Leeds 33 and YouTube is probably the best place to go to check out the lectures. They're all free lectures. I'm always going to post videos for free. So you can, if you know you're listening to this and you're like, I don't know about this guy, well, you can go and check out all of this stuff for free without giving me a cent of your money, you know. And if you like what you see, well, then, you know, help a brother out, you know, brothers got to eat too, you know. So and then I also, oh, one more thing, I also have a free blog on world-mysteries.com that you can check out, and I think I'll be posting another one hopefully next month. So yeah, lots of information to check out, like I said, basically for absolutely free. So
very good. We'll have the links up. Marty Leeds 33 is the main website. Go there and check that out. I want to ask you a little bit more about Claudia Bovonis and the peacock and everything else in the next segment. So stay with us, Marty. We'll take a short break here and we will be right back with more.
Temptation over.